Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, Gavin Newsom is our guest. Gavin is now the Lieutenant Governor of the state of California. He is the 49th Lieutenant Governor, and he was Mayor of San Francisco for two terms, the youngest mayor of San Francisco elected in more than 100 years. He also has a very strong business background. He founded 15 small businesses in the San Francisco Bay Area after graduating from college. And he's written his first book, and a fascinating one it is. For those of us who are not of the millennial generation, people who are under the age of 30, this whole world of technology and what we can do with it and how we use it is something that maybe we need to get up to speed on, because it probably is the way that we're going to interact. Well, it already is with each other, but maybe if governments are willing to embrace the new technology, the way that we interact with government. His book is Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. And the Lieutenant Governor traveled all over the country and interviewed a number of people, those who really understand this high-tech world, and those people who are in government who understand the need for government to be able to be much more transparent and give people a chance to communicate with them directly. So we're going to be talking with the Lieutenant Governor about this. He says that he believes, we're trying to get him on the line here, that's why I'm talking more, that we really need to be very transparent about government, and that we need to put resources in government as well to get the numbers and the quality of tech employees that are needed. We already use the internet to a remarkable degree to get campaigns up and running and to get money coming into campaigns. But what happens once somebody's elected? Where is the internet to communicate frequently? How important is that? How important is government being able to give us data? And as we found out lately with the Bush family being hacked, how important are things like privacy? Privacy, the Lieutenant Governor writes, as we've known it, is all but dead. And maybe it's okay to give up privacy. That might be just fine. But there's also a great inertia, government deciding that, and they've done this for a long time when new technologies are prevalent, that it's why is there such an inertia to move forward into using technology as it needs to be used? So that's what we hope to be talking about here momentarily. Our phone number, let me give you all the ways you can communicate as soon as we get him on the line, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to communicate via Facebook, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we also are on Twitter, as long as we're talking about high tech here, and that's @KDunnShow. @KDunnShow. So we're still attempting to reach him. Let me give you in a paragraph the substance of what the book is about. Government has to be, he writes, absolutely transparent. Every agency across the board, with exceptions only to protect public safety or personal privacy. We must make sure that our vast stores of data are available to ordinary people. Make sure they are standardized and easy to use. We must encourage people to use that data to create useful apps, devices. And we need to acknowledge that for a whole generation, and I think this is so true, of Americans under the age of 30, their reality is nothing like the reality of the over 30s. There's just a vast difference here. The digital natives, as opposed to digital immigrants who learned how to use technology later in life. And there may still be a gap, because if some people are like me, understand some of the technology, but you don't understand the full range of it, and your lives get so busy, it's hard to take a course or figure out all that you could be doing that you simply don't know how to do. So that's what the story is. But we don't have the Lieutenant Governor with us. So let me tell you a little bit about what might be coming up. I think we do have now. So feel free to join us. What do you think about the use of government? And some of you are of the millennial generation, and you just operate in this world that is so foreign to some older people. It's just instantaneous, and you don't worry as much about privacy issues, perhaps, as other people do. You put everything right out there for everybody to read, and that's probably the way that things are going to be in the future. But how can government function better embracing this whole technology? That's what we talk about. So we hope to have the Lieutenant Governor with us momentarily. I know that on Wednesday of this week, Chip Duncan, who's a documentary filmmaker from the Milwaukee area, has done a whole extensive documentary on the life of Ronald Reagan, and it starts this Wednesday evening on public television. We'll be speaking with Chip on Wednesday about Ronald Reagan. He spent a long time, I think I read 3 years, on this project and interviewed quite a cast of characters. That will be Wednesday. We'll be talking with him. And that's all I can remember at the moment. And we do have the Lieutenant Governor. Good, because I've almost run out of things to say. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, thank you very much for being with us.
My honor. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you here. It's really, the book is disturbing to me because I'm an older person and I got to get with it. And at some point in the interview, you can tell me how we learn all of this. But as you write early on in the book, the history of government is really a history of technophobia. What is the history?
Well, it's been top down, as many large institutions, governments no different. We've hired IT experts. We've built IT departments. We've hired lots of consultants, and we've engaged in multi-year contracts with very large vendors. And as a consequence, I call it the IT cartel. They've basically taken over these tools of technology. And the burden is we've got a legacy that goes back 20, 30 years with old technology that's no longer relevant to that world we're living in.
Mm-hmm. When you were mayor of San Francisco, you set out, your quest was to modernize San Francisco. What did you do? What results did you achieve?
Well, I mean, it fits and starts. And in the book, I'm very self-reflective about the areas where we advanced and the areas where we had setbacks. I mean, the core tenets of the book Citizenville is about open government. It's about transparency. And when I mean open government, I mean literally putting up to third-party developers, allowing information, data sets to be made available at the local level, at the state, national level, that allow people to take that raw data and to mix it up, mash it up, and to make it relevant in people's lives, not dissimilar to what Steve Jobs did when he created the frame of the iPhone, where he provided only 12 apps. Now there are over 800,000 apps on the iPhone. And he basically said, I'm in the platform business. I won't be in the apps business. And that's the way I see government increasingly moving from a vending machine approach, where you have a limited amount of choices, you put in your dollar taxes and get police, fire, health care, education, and if you don't like what you get, you shake the machine, the Occupy movement, and Tea Party, to this new notion of government as a platform, a framework of limitlessness, of abundance.
Mm. You tell this great story. There are a lot of great stories in the book, but the president of Estonia comes to visit you. It's kind of a big deal because you're the mayor, he's the president of a country, and lo and behold, this president is using, and this country is using, fairly sophisticated technology.
Well, this perfectly aligns to your previous question. So I thought, here I was, this hip mayor of San Francisco, just north of Silicon Valley, and I'm trying to impress this guy. He speaks perfect English, Tomas, but he started looking quizzically at his staff as if what I was saying wasn't translating. And I was trying to go on and talk about how we're going to have cell phones and smartphones where you can pay your parking meters, and I wanted to have free Wi-Fi in San Francisco. And he looked at me, and he finally shook his head and cut me off, and he said, hold on. We've been doing that for years. You can pay not only your parking tickets on your smartphone, but you can pay for almost anything, property taxes on down. And, of course, we've had Wi-Fi forever. And I learned a valuable lesson, and that is, number one, seek first to understand before you're understood. So be humble. Number two is the fact that they, when they pulled away from the old Soviet Union, didn't have the burden of the legacy that I described in the outset, these old top-down information technology systems and contracts. They skipped that generation, and as a consequence, they moved to these mobile devices where now they have a 200% penetration rate, meaning there are two cell phones on average for every citizen in Estonia.
Goodness.
And so they've been able to move much more swiftly.
Yeah. Well, let's look at campaigns, because as we all know, there have been some very sophisticated political, particularly presidential campaigns, being able to rally people to get money, et cetera. But once the campaign is over,
You got it. We're very good at amplifying your voice when we want to be heard and we want to get elected. We're very good at organizing and getting you to volunteer. We certainly are good at getting your checkbook out or your credit card swiped. And all of that leads to Election Day, where we use the tools of technology relatively well to get you to vote. But the day after the election, boy, all of a sudden, those tools of technology go away. That two-way conversation we were having on the campaign becomes then a one-way broadcast conversation, which is increasingly, I think, leaving people wanting. And my whole principle of this book is we've got to use the tools of technology not just to self-organize communities to support a candidate of choice, but to begin to self-organize and generate the collective wisdom, that collective network of intelligence that exists out there, to be co-creators in the life of our city and our state and nation, where we're actually part and participatory actively in legislation and civic engagement.
So give me an idea, Lieutenant Governor Newsom, how this would all work. We could use technology to do what?
Well, that's the beauty, limitlessness, meaning to do about everything. I'm not calling for replacing government as we know it, traditional government, with a computer by no stretch of the imagination. But what I'm talking about is a hybrid form of governance. Think about this. I have a 3-year-old daughter. I thought she was a prodigy. I'm not kidding. When she was one, she grabbed my iPhone.
Yes, I know.
And
I know.
We all know it. Anyone listening knows it too. They've seen their grandkids or they've seen their kids. Until literally about 6 months ago, she got into preschool. They do start them early. And I looked around, and all these kids were prodigies, which suggested maybe none of them are. They're growing up digital. This is the participation generation, as they've been called. And as a consequence, you can't educate these kids the way we got educated. There is no mass education formula for a generation of choice that everything's being customized for. Mm-hmm. Then think of that example, and then think about what we have at government when we go to the DMV or we try to pay our parking tickets or fines. We've got an old industrial model of governance, top down, not side by side, big and slow. And these whole generation of folks is growing up where things are ubiquitous, where it's mobile, social, local, cloud, seamless. It's not siloed. And people are collaborating, connecting in real time, and there's an iterative two-way conversation going on, peer-to-peer. And so that's this, from my perspective, this growing new digital divide between government and the private sector.
So we may need to put them in charge, because the rest of us, only a few of us, we don't know what's going on, really.
Well, it's the first generation of children that actually are experts in something their parents are not.
You're right.
Think about that.
Right,
and,
right.
So it's a reverse mentorship. In many ways, we should be getting young mentors. You don't be mentored by an elder, but by someone, you know, or as maybe to be more fair, as an old Bobby Kennedy fan, he says, what the world needs are the qualities of youth. Not a time of life, but a state of mind, a quality of imagination.
Nice. Very nice. And your daughter may be a prodigy. We want to clear that up, right?
We all think ours are, don't we?
Yeah. You mentioned cloud. See, I don't even, what is cloud? I know you write about it, but what is it?
It's an on-demand resource. Basically, in the old days, you would have to build the equivalent of a power plant to generate electricity. And then they created wires, and all of a sudden you can centralize the power plant. And now you just, instead of building one or even buying one, you can literally rent at access to the servers, to the memory, to the brain. And that's what a cloud ultimately provides the ability to do. It creates a seamlessness, a ubiquity of information that could be shared and allows people to collaborate in real time in ways that didn't exist before, because everyone had to have their separate brain that was attached to their device. Now you go to a centralized brain and you just take a portion of that as needed with the latest technology and iteration. So it's one of the most dominant shifts in computing in the last few years, and it's going to be the new norm. Government, though, is still not adopting cloud-based systems because of the legacy burdens. We're beginning to slowly adapt, and as we do, we'll see cost drop significantly, and we'll see a substantial increase in quality of services.
You talk about how things really labor along, government labors along on these issues, and I'd like for you to talk about an incident, and it called for you to see yourself burned in effigy, as you write, which happened to you more than once. 2002, you're fighting for a new program called Care Not Cash. You're dealing with a record number of homeless people who are living on the streets of San Francisco. And there really isn't a lot of data available, maybe because technology hasn't kept up, that allows people to buy into this program. Can you talk more about it?
Yeah, I mean, the reason there wasn't a lot of data is that it was no, you know, they're all, there's, here's the old adage. If you want to move the mouse, you've got to move the cheese. If you want to change people's behavior, you have to change incentives. And there's never been an incentive to focus on technology and government. I mean, there's not a big group of people that show up at a city council meeting demanding more technology investment. In fact, I've never been to one where they were demanding more technology investment, but they sure as heck would demand more services to the most vulnerable citizens. And that's appropriate and right. That said, in San Francisco, we were no different. And we were having a debate about what I would argue is how we can fail more efficiently. We were not having a debate about how we can solve a problem, but how we can manage the issue of homelessness a little bit better. And the debate was about spending more money. And look, I'm a lifelong progressive Democrat, and I'll put up my credentials up with the best of them. But one thing I've learned the hard way, and I think it's the hard-headed pragmatism of being mayor, is that more is not always better. Better is better. And we were providing all these resources, but things kept getting worse. More homeless were dying. Our emergency rooms were overwhelmed on the 1st and 15th of the month because people were picking up checks, and so often they were suffering from addiction and suffering from the predatory nature of the environment around them. And we said, let's create a pattern interrupt here, as they say in psychology, and let's look at this cash-based system where we're providing $400 a month in cash as care and convert it to guaranteed access to service. But guaranteed was the underscore that we adopted. And what happened long-windedly is we reduced the caseload by about 83%. We turned the system around dramatically, reduced the number of people on the streets and sidewalks by well over a third, and adopted a more disciplined measure of our effectiveness using now the tools of technology and ultimately the cloud to begin to make sure that we weren't replicating services, we were streamlining them, and that we were carrying a framework of real responsibility to solving the issue of poverty, not just managing the issue.
Lieutenant Governor Newsom, as you put this book together, you traveled and interviewed many, many people. Did you concentrate on interviewing government people who were using technology in a modern fashion? Did you talk to tech people about how to do this? Who did you talk to?
All of the above. And it was interesting, you know, I was thinking to myself, and you know, I'd been working over at Current TV for Al Gore, and I started thinking as I'm watching the former vice president run upstairs to his office, and this was the inspiration in many ways of the book, what would Al Gore be doing and former President Clinton with their Reinvent Government initiative that got a lot of attention in the early 90s with the tools of technology today? What would that Reinvent Government look like if they were going to begin anew to begin to redesign government agencies and services with the not only the cloud, but 4G and all these new things that are part of the nomenclature of the world we're living in. And so I interviewed them, but then I started meeting with Sheryl Sandberg, CEO of Facebook, and the founder, co-founder, Evan Williams of Twitter, who's a friend, and others. And even, interestingly, of all people, George Clooney is in the book, because the issue of privacy came up. And I thought, what more interesting person to talk to about privacy than someone in the public eye that has as much scrutiny as most politicians? And so that was the one. Those are a few of the 67 or so folks that I interviewed over a year and a half.
And let's talk about privacy, because as I recall, Clooney is not on Facebook because of privacy issues for him. You are not as concerned about privacy, and it seems to me as though we may have to give up some of our privacy in order to advance technologically, but there are serious concerns when it comes to this issue.
Yeah, I mean, I come at this from a very pragmatic and hard-headed perspective. I would like to think that we would value our privacy as we've known it in this last generation or so. It's interesting, you know, I talked to a number of leaders who made the case that privacy is a relatively new construct in human history, that the old days of the tribal nature of localization, that first phase of human history, there wasn't much privacy at all. It was only until we started to urbanize and come into cities where we became a little bit more anonymous and were able to develop the construct as we know it today of privacy. Now, as we move to the third phase, not local, not centralized in that industrial frame, but to a people-centric view, the issue of privacy is running right up to the edge of technology. And from my perspective, privacy and transparency go hand in hand in this way. I want more transparency. That includes access to my information. It's informed consent that I believe in, real transparency as it relates to informed consent. There's a whole generation, this net generation, this millennial generation, that may be less sensitive to their privacy because it's a currency and they can sell their privacy to get the latest service. Mm. But for some of us digital immigrants that are learning to speak this language, we may not want to give up that privacy and actually not look at privacy as a currency and actually spend the extra dollar or two for that improved service. And so that's where I come off. It's we're going through a difficult transition, but if you think you can keep information private, just consider what the president just went through on the drone issues. Consider WikiLeaks.
Right. Consider George Bush's paintings.
And that too. Right. You're absolutely right.
He's not bad, really.
Not bad. I won't bore you with a story about his paintings, but you're right. He's not bad. He's found a new passion.
Oh, I want to hear the story. Sorry. What's the story?
I happened to be with former President Clinton and the Clinton Global Initiative when former President Bush's daughter ran up to Bill and started going on and on about how his father has found this new passion in painting. And President Clinton was remarking to his daughter that he not only knows that, but he had a chance to see some of the work and absolutely admired it. And it was just a wonderful conversation where there's no politics, just human conversation with the daughter of a former president and, of course, President Clinton himself. And it's interesting, without talking too far out of school, but the conversation lent itself to an interesting query that former President Bush made about what ex-presidents were doing with their time. And one of the things he discovered is some of them had discovered talents they never knew they had. And one of the talents that he discovered in turn was that he might indeed be an artist. And he is spending apparently a great deal of time expressing himself accordingly.
Yeah. Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom, is our guest this hour. He's the former mayor of San Francisco. And he is the author of a really interesting book. It takes us into the future. It motivates government to look at technology and how it can use it so that we can understand what government is doing and government can listen to what it is we want, moving us into a new age, which we seem reluctant to do. And it's time for it to happen. It is happening. You look at people, as he said, his one-year-old daughter, who's now three and very proficient, I'm sure, on all of this technology. Those of us who have children know how true this is. And there are a lot of significant issues can we make government a whole lot better if we embrace this technology? Why are we reluctant to do so? What about the issues of privacy? He also, as you know, was the mayor of San Francisco for two terms and is a nationally known figure. He's the 49th lieutenant governor of the state of California. Here's our phone number. Join our conversation. We would like to hear from you about this important issue. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And, oh, I should also say, to be truly with it, you can send us a tweet at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom, is our guest this hour. His book is Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. Our number is 800-486-8655. Joe in Duluth is our first caller. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Well, my concern is that in some cases, technology seems to be going beyond and being more distracting than useful. I sent an email last night to four recipients, two of which will probably be sitting down at their PC or their laptop and actually thinking about what the thoughtful email that I sent. The other two may very well be shopping or some other multitask situation, and it may not really get right into them exactly what I'm saying. And I could envision the entire Senate or possibly Congress sitting in their seats while the general operations of the Senate are going on and responding to texts and emails and things like that. I just wondered why I spent so much time putting such a thoughtful email together when some of the recipients are going to be multitasking while they receive it.
Can you tell us what you wrote? Joe, can you tell us what you wrote about? Was it to politicians?
I wrote about tasks that I need them to do, that we need to do in order to succeed in this business.
Okay.
And
all right, Lieutenant Governor?
Well, no, Joe, I get exactly what you're saying, and it's a legitimate point of concern. I mean, this more thoughtful, reflective, deliberative world that we've known, where we can sit back, pause, where we're spending more time face to face, and having a more Socratic engagement. You're right, it's being pushed aside for a world where people are talking about tweeting a constitution, what some have referred to as the age of amateurs, where people are utilizing these tools of technology to amplify their voices. And, you know, we've got a generation of folks that are literally making hundreds of thousands of, or sending hundreds of thousands of text messages before their 18th birthday. And by the way, that's not an exaggeration.
I know.
And so it's just, this is the world we're now entering into. This is the world, again, I would argue we're already living in. And what's happened with technology, and perhaps, having grown up in Silicon Valley and in the San Francisco Bay Area, you know, you think back, 2005, when Tom Friedman wrote a wonderful book called The World is Flat. I was just meeting with the New York Times columnist for an event I had in Silicon Valley, and he made the point, you know, in that book, 2005, Facebook wasn't in the book. He said Twitter was a sound. He mentioned, as I said, 4G at the time was a parking space. The cloud was in the sky. Apps were things you filled out to get in the University of Wisconsin. And Skype, for most of us, was a typo. Those things didn't exist as we know them today, six, 7 years ago. So it's exponential. The rate of technological change is exponential. The mobility now. PCs are being challenged. Now it's all mobile. It's what we call mobile, local, social, cloud, social media, along the lines of Facebook, a localization of services where they're geospatially mapping where you are. So you walk by a store and it says, hey, this coffee store offers a discount because they know you were there previously. It is very specialized. It's very ubiquitous as it relates to being able to access that cloud on the move, and it's a dramatic shift from the world we've all known.
Mm. Thank you very much, Joe, for the call. Cliff in Lake Geneva. Hi, Cliff.
Hi.
Hi.
My response is the communications on the local level. A few years ago, I had something important that was very important to a local official, and there was no way to get a hold of him. No emails, no phone numbers. He wasn't listed in the book.
Oh, my.
If the only way to get a hold of him is to wait for the next council meeting. And in that time space, things could have went bad for him. And, you know, with all the technology and stuff, it's got to start with the individual and the bottom, you know, grassroots local government.
Yeah. Well, Cliff, I agree with you. My bias is local. I've sort of long joked that if you don't like the way the world looks when you're standing up, stand on your head and go local, and you'll see some remarkable things and innovation happening and occurring. What I talk about in this book is not replacing the town square, but enabling more voices to participate in virtualizing the town square, because one precept that I just accept, and I come from the private sector, I come with a business background with about 1,000 employees in the businesses I started, is what I've learned the hard way is one-way conversations are dead. The broadcast model that has existed in the past, where again, you vote, I decide, I broadcast for 4 years, then I engage you to get reelected, those days are over in the private sector, not just in the public square. There has to be an iterative two-way conversation, and the tools of technology can enable that if, as you say, individually, there's a commitment to making that real.
Hmm. You write about attending the World Economic Summit in 2005, where, and maybe this was a light bulb going off for you, that the new technology handheld device allowed people to quietly vote, as you write, on their priorities rather than having to travel to city meetings and strive to argue the loudest for their positions. They could sit in their seats, even at home, and express their opinions. How widely is that being used now?
It's being used, but those are the early embers of this new contour that was taking shape with technology. And again, reflecting in 2005 how different the world is just 7-8 years later. The fact is, look, I love town hall meetings, but let's not deny the obvious. So often, not in every case, but so often, only certain group of people are privileged to go because of the times they're scheduled. Second, they tend to be people with particular special interests, which is fabulous if it's one that I embrace, and they sometimes take over the meetings. And the average citizen feels left out or feels like their voice doesn't really matter or it's being drowned out. And so technology creates a safer place for real deliberation where you can go on and without feeling like you're going to get screamed at by the masses, you can express a different point of view. And so that was sort of the early example of some of the things that I tried as mayor. But now you have much more dynamic sites. Quora.com is an example. That Localocracy is another example where these are real digital town halls with a safe place for real civic engagement at a time when we really need to bring that deliberative citizen engagement back to the town square more than ever.
Yeah. Thank you, Cliff, for the call. Let's go to Ron in Milwaukee. Hi, Ron.
Good morning. One of my concerns is, and I think this all sounds good, I buy into it, but one of my concerns is that there is a widening gap between how available information is in the public and private sectors and how it can be used. And my example is, here in Wisconsin, we had a recall election, and the people who signed the petition to recall the governor were put into a public database online and essentially, in some cases, blacklisted after that.
Yes.
In the public sector here, if you're a public employee, the state of Wisconsin, all of your salary data is available online to anybody, which sounds good on the surface. I mean, we should know, you know, how much the government is spending, but do we need to know what an individual person is making? If I'm interested in a job in state government, I'm not sure I want to take the job if that kind of level of detail is going to be available and, and impinge upon my privacy. And finally, I think part of the problem with government and making it open is that government is busy making itself private. It's outsourcing a lot of its work to the private sector. And the private sector, even corporations who have to answer to stockholders, in many cases can withhold data.
Yep. No, Ron, let me move backwards from your points. All valid points. Look, the increasing privatization of government is a point of real concern for me as well. And it's not just to private for-profit corporations. I will say it's to non-profit organizations that also are opaque and lack the kind of transparency that is absolutely essential. Remember, this is not someone else's money. It's not government money. It's not my money as an elected official. It's your money. It's the taxpayers' money. And there really does need to be that type of transparency. And I do, and I appreciate your point of view about how things can be used and abused. And I certainly been on the receiving end of that for many years in elected office about my salary, et cetera. But I think public has the right to know what they pay elected officials, but also what they pay citizens that are participating as government employees in their public service as well. Because again, it's the taxpayers, it's the public's money. As it relates to the petition, that's very disconcerting, and that's a point of legitimate concern, that people should have the right to petition their government without fear of being blacklisted or labeled as somehow other, and that information being used against you. And that's why this issue of transparency needs to be cautiously adopted and implemented. It's just not an across-the-board. Everything is always public all the time. It's an issue that is a very difficult to approximate what the right answer is, but you want us to go about deliberating about that on a consistent basis.
Thank you very much, Ron, for your important call. All right, let's get to what many of us who are way over 30 are facing right now, Lieutenant Governor Newsom, and that's this information gap. Just it's been my New Year's resolution for I can't tell you how many years now to really get up to speed with all of this, and I get halfway there on new technology, but I've got this block. You know, it's like learning a trigonometry or something. It just, it's very, very hard. And I can't be alone in this. I know I'm not alone in this.
No.
So how do we all become millennials?
Well, as I said, reverse mentorship. It's, you know, time to bring the kids in and put them in front of the classrooms. But I think here's the good news, is the technology is and particularly the new technology that's coming out, as I said, which is it's focused on four core tenets: mobile, social, local, and cloud. The move away from PCs as we know it, desktops, now to mobile phones and smartphones, the ability for information to be localized to your community, to your neighborhood, to your individual needs, and the issue of social in every respect, a two-way conversation, community, self-organization of like-minded people, and we hope increasingly of people that have different points of view, which is important. The good news, though, is the technologies are becoming more people-centric. The technologies and the technologists are recognizing exactly your concern. And the ease to which, for example, Steve Jobs provided that platform of the iPhone is, I think, the example of what's to come with these new tools of technology that are going to become more intuitive and more streamlined and much more obvious in terms of their ability to use and to access.
When's it going to happen?
It's taking shape now. It's already taking shape, you know, but don't get me wrong. I mean, as soon as there's, you know, the hot thing now is Pinterest. And, was it Facebook? Is Facebook done or is that still growing? Twitter, is it still, you can't keep up with all these things.
Right.
And every week there's a new app that you've got to get, got to try. And so the key is now, there's this framework they're all talking about called the Internet of Things. In essence, we are, and all of us listening, I don't care if you feel like you only have a few weeks left, chances are you're going to start experiencing this Internet of Things where everything is connected. Literally, pens are connected to paper. Paper connected through these tools of technology to your phone communicating with other devices. We're seeing it with cars now. Cars are literally becoming computational, et cetera. So this world is changing at a rapid rate. Artificial intelligence, the cost of sensors dropping significantly, the convergence of technologies, one technology now converting and meeting another technology, data sets that are being made spatially easy to understand and design, this whole notion of designing data, all of that's beginning to take shape. And so it's an exciting, exciting whitewater of change in the next 4 or 5 years.
I'm scared.
Don't be embrace.
All right. I hear you. The Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom, is our guest this hour. His book, Citizenville: How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. You can go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or we are on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest, Gavin Newsom, Lieutenant Governor of California, two-term mayor of San Francisco, and a gentleman who has developed many, many businesses, came out of the private sector before his illustrious public sector career. The book is Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. Mark in Richland Center, hi.
Good morning. This whole power of the populace has... maybe called out by the Occupy movement, and the Lieutenant Governor has mentioned the business of abundance. There is a movement afoot that says that we are not short by anything except what maybe we're using for money, but using digital money in terms of, say, time banks and local currencies and such like that would give a town, our little town of Richland Center started a time bank 3 years ago, because two ladies looked around and said, look at everything that happens in this town. How could we ever be broke? If we actually give credit to the doers within the economy, which is truly us, we are the economy, not what currency happens to be in circulation, then all of the doing that can be done is actually credited through this digital currency, and nothing could actually go undone simply because we're looking in our pockets for something that is in short supply, when in fact... the sun came up, we got up, all of the doing that can be done can now be done digitally by simply tracking the doing of the doers, and everybody gets credit for what they do, and nobody can actually be shorted in a system like that unless you do not do.
Oh, that's fascinating, Mark. There's a talk show coming on that one.
Yeah. I love that, Mark. I mean, this is the whole idea of the Commonwealth. This is, you know, in so many ways, this is what this book's about. It's about civic currency and creating a new civic software. I use examples, and I may need to add, in fact, I'm going to add this opportunity to talk about what you've just provided me, but Manor, Texas, they did something called InnoBucks, a small town, about 5,000 folks. This remarkable person felt the same way you did in your small town, an example, and created this civic currency that actually could be used for discounts in restaurants and various participating businesses, and was a board of civic engagement that the local newspaper promoted in terms of finding a way to provide value for people's participation and for their contribution. So it's exactly the spirit of what this book's about and what technology can do, not to alienate us, but to re-engage us.
Thank you, Mark. Send us more information about what's happening in Richland Center, and we will do a show on that down the road. Thank you. Craig in Pewaukee. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Okay.
Good.
Hey, I wanted to mention about, I haven't heard you quite touch on, you're talking a lot about the data that's being moved back and forth and the sharing of information, but I haven't heard you touch too much on the move to automation and robotics in factories. Now, this has been going on since Henry Ford put together the first assembly line, but now it's reaching the point where we're actually doing away with workers completely. I don't know if you've seen the article out of MIT's, I think it's their MIT's Business Review, where they had their robot that sells for roughly $20,000, I think, that can displace a worker and last for at least 3 years before replacement. And when you push this through, I mean, basically we're in a state where technology is moving, that there's really very few jobs that can't be automated.
No, and I think it's the cruel reality of the world we're living in, is we've merged from a globalized society to the merger of IT and globalization. We call this hyper-connected, not just connected world we're living in. And we've certainly seen the hollowing out, and it's been a big part of the mystery of the loss of our middle class, is huge productivity enhancements and declining wages. I mean, perfect example is Caterpillar, one of the largest manufacturers in the United States, last year had record profits. At the same time, they suspended any wage increases for the next 6 years. How can that be? And it again goes to the issue of your concern of automation. And let me just underscore that concern by giving you one just quick example. I was reading in the newspaper the other day about a young kid, and the article was The New Face of Manufacturing. He had his iPad and he designed a product in Taiwan. He rented robots by the hour to manufacture it in China. He sent it out to Seattle to do his procurement and fulfillment at Amazon. He went on Craigslist to get his accountant, and he went on freelancer.com to get the logo done. The new face of manufacturing, not made in Wisconsin, not made in this country, but made in the world. And so it is a point of legitimate concern and fear and anxiety. Now, here's the good news. Innovation creates jobs. It just doesn't take jobs away. And what we're starting to see now is a lot of onshoring of these manufacturers coming back to the United States because of the issue of localization again, the need to be closer connected to their consumers. And I'm starting to see the new contours, particularly now, of 3D manufacturing, of additive manufacturing, where people are literally printing products from their desktop computers. This exists today. Autodesk in San Francisco can demonstrate it to anyone who wishes to visit their headquarters, that manufacturing now is beginning to dramatically change with advanced manufacturing, robotics, artificial intelligence, the precipitous drop in the price of sensors. So it's a disruptive time, but at the same time, I think we're going to start seeing the contours of American jobs once again being on the vanguard and forefront as we move through this innovative period in a way where we come out stronger.
That's fascinating. Craig, thanks for your call. Nathaniel in Campbellsport, hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
I paid my sales tax for my business the other day by printing out the form online where I used to have to drive to the library.
Mm.
And then the form is, you know, we've got telefile everything now. I mean, now I can even pay my sales tax, all kinds of quarterly payments, everything on the phone. So I was able to do all my own accounting and not and pay the sales tax without leaving the house. Pretty slick. but I still like the fact, and I'm 32, so I'm supposed to be in the ooh-rah-rah technological generation, but I still like the fact that I can go down to the library
sure.
and go get that form and send it in the mail.
And say hi, and how you doing? Right.
Right, and also, you know, we talk about the cloud, and that sounds good, and it is amazing. I know we're not going backwards in any of the new ways that human brains are working together. I know we're not going backwards in that regard, but it's not a cloud. It's a climate-controlled warehouse somewhere with, like, 25 miles of wire and guys out back on their smoke break and people digging molybdenum with their hands in Central Congo. And I get a little worried when we think that it's going to make government just all around more light of foot.
Okay. Lieutenant Governor.
Well, I mean, by the way, I love what you say about the library. I was very proud as mayor to expand library hours and to put together a bond to revitalize all of our libraries. But again, utilizing a new construct of making our libraries community centers and taking advantage of these tools of technology so that everyone can take advantage of them, regardless of their socioeconomic status. But you're right. I mean, there is ultimately, you're right, this world brain is connected somewhere to something. And, you know, some have joked that that factory has two employees. It's a dog and a human being. The human being's there to feed the dog, and the dog's there to make sure that the human being doesn't touch all the computers. So you're not wrong in that concern. But the bottom line is businesses, private sector businesses, particularly big business now, and it's going to increasingly going to devolve down to small business, are taking advantage of these tools of technology to be much more efficient and effective and engage their customers in a new conversation. Government, that's my fundamental frame, must do the same.
Yeah. Time for one more phone call, and it's from California, San Luis Obispo. Eric is calling. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to talk about local government learning. In San Luis Obispo, I'm able to watch my local government meetings stream over the internet, so I don't have to go to the actual meeting.
Uh-huh.
And I'm also able to look at all the archives of meetings that have already taken place and do keyword word searches on the reports that have been created.
You're living what Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom has written about, right, Lieutenant Governor?
Yeah, but I want Eric to take the next step, and I want him to utilize all that information and the ability to access and watch someone else participate in a debate, but actually become a co-creator in the legislation that's being discussed, to be an active participant in that city council meeting in a way that only these tools of technology can provide. And that's the great opportunity. It's not just e-government. It's not just about online forms I'm advocating. It's about a new division of labor. It's about a new kind of citizen engagement that will enliven people to once again reconnect with their neighborhoods, their town, and their community, and again, the states that we're all trying to build.
Oh, this was fascinating. Thank you so much for being with us. Thanks for writing the book.
Honored. Thanks so much for having me.
Our guest, the Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom. He was the mayor of San Francisco for two terms and has a long career in business as well. The book is Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, for doing on-air production as well here in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. Until tomorrow.